You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
Let's begin the reading of today's Boston Globe for the 6th of April, 2026. And with the Boston Globe, we say hello to Grant and Richard.
Thank you, John. From the front page of the Boston Globe, Trump sharpens threat to civilian targets. In profanity-laced message to Iran, he vows attacks on power grid bridges unless Strait of Hormuz is opened. Article by David E. Sanger and Thomas Fuller, New York Times. In a message that was stunning for its crude combativeness and profanity, President Trump on Easter morning renewed his threat to destroy Iranian electricity facilities and bridges unless Iran reopened the Strait of Hormuz. Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day all wrapped up in one in Iran, Trump wrote a little after 8 a.m. Eastern Time Sunday. Open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah. The president sent the message just hours after he announced the recovery of a downed airman from the mountains in Iran on Saturday night, a high-risk operation that deprived Iran of the leverage of capturing an American prisoner of war. After 5 weeks of war, Trump's threat seemed to signal a more dangerous level of brinkmanship for the global economy. Destroying Iran's power grid could also be catastrophic for Iran's more than 90 million people, plunging the country into darkness. Iran's selective blockage of the Strait of Hormuz, the critical gateway to Persian Gulf oil and gas, has already created shortages of jet fuel and sent global oil prices surging. A spiraling cycle of attacks and retribution involving oil and gas facilities could worsen the global energy shock. The cycle has already begun. On Saturday, the Israeli military struck Iran's largest petrochemical complex in Mashahar in southwest Iran. Those strikes were followed Sunday by Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz threatening to step up attacks on Iran's petrochemical industry, saying the sector had brought in approximately $18 billion to support Iran's Revolutionary Guard in the past 2 years. Iran has retaliated against the relentless U.S. and Israeli bombings with strikes on Gulf energy and water facilities. Bahrain's Gulf Petrochemical Industries Company said Sunday that an Iranian drone attack caused fires at several of its operational units. Kuwaiti authorities said Sunday that drone strikes they attributed to Iran hit an oil complex in the Shuwaik district in Kuwait City. Other Iranian strikes in Kuwait significantly damaged two power and water desalination plants, forcing the shutdown of two electricity-generating units, authorities said. In the United Arab Emirates, several fires broke out at a petrochemical factory on Sunday, the Abu Dhabi media office said, adding that the fires were sparked by falling debris from successful air defense interceptions. In an interview with Fox News on Sunday, Trump said he believes a deal could be reached by Monday with Iran, but that failing an agreement, I'm considering blowing everything up and taking over the oil. The president added that Iranians who are negotiating have been granted amnesty to continue the talks. Iran has denied that it is in direct talks with the United States to end the war, but messages have been sent through Pakistani mediators. In response to Trump's threat that he would attack Iranian power plants and bridges, Mizan, an outlet affiliated with Iran's judiciary, said that Iran's steadfastness and resistance have driven Trump to the brink of madness. Trump also faced sharp criticism at home. On social media, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, called Trump's Easter morning message completely, utterly unhinged. Representative Don Bacon, a Nebraska Republican, said in a text message that Americans don't want their president to be profane and vulgar. He added, part of leadership is self-control. Trump's threats may be interpreted by Iran as a bluff. The president issued a 48-hour deadline in late March for Iran to reopen the waterway, but he postponed it by 5 days shortly after markets opened the following Monday, saying that Iran had begun to negotiate with the United States. By the end of the week, Trump had given Iranian leaders until April 6th to reach a deal. Under the Geneva Conventions, striking power plants and bridges that are used primarily by civilians is off-limits. They are not considered military targets. Administration officials are already beginning to make the argument that hitting this type of infrastructure would not be a war crime because it is also crucial to Iran's missile and nuclear programs. But that argument could apply to almost any piece of civilian infrastructure, even water supplies. Katz justified Saturday's attack on the Mashar petrochemical complex on the grounds that it directly serves the Iranian surface-to-surface missile production industry and constituted a significant part of the Iranian economy that enables the government to produce the weapons it fires at Israel. Trump's vehement message Sunday could underscore to the Iranians how powerful a tool control of the Strait of Hormuz remains. The constriction of oil from the Gulf, which experts have described as the largest cut to oil supplies in history, is perhaps Iran's most effective remaining weapon after the loss of its navy, air force, and much of its arsenal of missiles and launchers. In addition to being the passageway for about 20% of global oil exports, the strait is a conduit for fertilizer and for helium, which is critical to the manufacture of semiconductors. Iran threatened further disruptions to global trade Sunday when Ali Akbar Velayati, an advisor to Iran's new supreme leader, Mojiba Khamenei, said the country could close another statistic waterway, the Strait of Bab al-Mandab, a narrow shipping route at the southern end of the Red Sea. During Israel's war on the Gaza Strip, the Iranian-backed Houthi militia in Yemen struck ships in the Red Sea, causing severe disruptions to global trade. Trump is considering a ground operation to open the Strait of Hormuz, but it would be complex, and he may well require taking the Iranian shoreline of the strait and perhaps part of the Persian Gulf. Iran has many options to interfere with shipping, including mines and speedboats that can be used to launch shoulder-fired, short-range missiles that might make passage risky enough that shippers will not try to run through the narrow strait. Trump has called on European nations, China and India, all of which depend heavily on oil that moves through the strait, to join an international coalition to keep it open. But because none of those countries were consulted about Trump's decision to attack Iran, and some believe the war to be illegal or unwise. Grant.
Richard, this story of rescue of airmen was a harrowing race against time. While U.S. Iran searched, he hid in mountain crevice. Article by Greg Jaffe, Helene Cooper, Eric Schmidt, and Julian E. Barnes of the New York Times. It's Dateline Washington. The two crew members ejected from their fighter jet just seconds after it was hit by Iranian fire. The F-15E Strike Eagle, the first fighter jet lost to enemy fire in the war, crashed to the ground. The Air Force officers were deep in hostile territory Friday morning alone and armed only with pistols. The plane's pilot was in constant communication with his unit and was rescued about 6 hours later by a force that included attack planes and helicopters that came under heavy fire, military officials said. But the aircraft's weapons systems officer was missing. In the chaos of the ejection, a violent life-saving maneuver, he had become separated from the pilot, setting off a vast search that became the primary focus for the U.S. military troops and CIA officers across the entire theater for 2 days. This account of the weapons officer's fight for survival and rescue is based on interviews with about a dozen current and former military and administration officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the sensitive operation. Surveillance planes and drones combed the area near where the plane had crashed, but could not find the weapons officer or any signs that he was alive, a military official briefed on the rescue said. On the ground in Iran, the downed officer's mission boiled down to two words, evasion and survival. Surrounded by potential enemies, he hiked up a 7,000-foot ridgeline and wedged himself into a crevice where he hoped he would be safe until U.S. officers found him, U.S. military officials said. U.S. Central Command was preparing a statement that the plane had gone down and the pilot had been rescued. But just as they were about to release the statement, about 14 hours after the fighter jet was hit, U.S. officials got a lock on their weapons officer's location via a beacon he was carrying. Air Force fighter pilots and weapons officers are equipped with beacons and secure communications devices for coordinating with their rescuers, but they are trained not to signal their location constantly and to restrict use of the beacon, which can be spotted by the enemy, a military official said. Central Command officials immediately scrapped the statement they were preparing to release. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth called President Trump and told him that as long as there was a chance that they could find the weapons officer, they needed to keep information about the pilot's rescue secret. Iran had launched several search parties, one of which had assembled at the base of the mountain where the weapons officer was hiding. For the Iranians, the downed Air Force colonel was a powerful asset they could use as leverage in high-stakes negotiations with the United States. For the U.S. military, which lives by the mantra of no man left behind, finding the downed officer was a moral imperative. Battered by the force from his ejection, the weapons officer waited. He knew that both U.S. and Iranian forces were racing to find him. A military official described the weapons officer's signaling as intermittent. The first task for the military was making sure that the person signaling was the weapons officer and not someone in Iran who had found his equipment. At its campus in Langley, Virginia, the CIA was developing a deception plan to buy the U.S. military and the airmen more time. They spread word in Iran that the airman had been found and was being moved out of the country in a ground convoy. The hope was that the Iranians would shift their search from the place where the airman was thought to be and focus instead on the roads out of the region. The Iranians, however, intensified their search, calling on the public via the state's primary broadcaster to capture the enemy's pilot or pilots and turn them over alive to security forces for a reward. On Saturday morning, Trump was escalating his threats against Iran, vowing to blow up the country's electrical infrastructure unless its leaders opened the Strait of Hormuz to all traffic. Time is running out, 48 hours before all hell will rain down on them, Trump wrote on social media. At that moment, U.S. military officials were in the final stages of preparing a vast and complex rescue mission that involved about 100 special operations forces led by elements of SEAL Team 6, with Delta Force commandos and Army Rangers on standby if needed. A far larger conventional force made up of helicopters, surveillance planes, fighters, and aerial tankers was ready to provide support. As U.S. military officials said, it took hours to get the weapons officer's location and determine that it was him. Military officials were assisted by the CIA, which used a special piece of technology unique to the agency to locate the airman hiding in the mountain crevice and confirm his identity. Once they determined the airman was alone, senior military officials waited until dark to launch a rescue mission. Special operations helicopters loaded with commandos raced to the remote mountain site where he was waiting. A senior U.S. official described the rescue mission as one of the most challenging and complex in the history of U.S. special operations. The commandos had to contend with the mountainous terrain, the Iranian forces that they assumed would attack them, and the injured airman's health, which was uncertain. As the commandos landed on the objective, U.S. and Israeli warplanes dropped bombs whose bright orange blasts lit up the silhouettes of the surrounding mountains. The commandos fired their weapons ferociously to keep any Iranians in the area from advancing toward them, but they did not engage in a firefight with enemy forces. U.S. officials described the territory where the airman was hiding as strongly opposed to the Iranian regime and said it was unclear how close Iranian forces ever got to the site. He was rushed to a helicopter that whisked him off to a sandy, austere airstrip inside Iran that special operations forces had developed for possible rescues or other contingencies. The plan was to immediately load the airmen and the rescue force onto two C-130 aircraft that were supposed to carry them out of danger to an airfield in Kuwait. But in a final twist, the nose gear of at least one and possibly both of those planes got stuck in the sandy dirt at the airstrip, military officials said. Eventually, the commandos and the injured weapons systems operator were reloaded onto three newly arrived replacement aircraft after the rescue team left. American warplanners bombed the two disabled planes rather than let them fall into the Iranian hands. As the sun was rising, the three planes launched in succession from the remote airstrip. The plane carrying the rescued airman was first. When word reached the White House that the aircraft had cleared Iranian airspace, Trump announced the mission's success. The rescued officer had sustained injuries, Trump wrote, but would be just fine. Richard.
Well, thank you, Grant. This from the front page of the Boston Globe. Refuse to stop. A creed for marathon. life. Dr. 80 battles anemia, diabetes, cancer as he heads to starting line. Article written by Claire Thornton, Globe staff. Severe hot flashes, testosterone deficiency, anemia, type 2 diabetes. Michael Holick has long battled many side effects as part of his cancer treatments. They won't stop the 80-year-old doctor from running his third consecutive Boston Marathon this month. Holick, who was diagnosed with stage 3 prostate cancer in 2021, is one of the oldest runners in this year's race. Out of 30,000 runners, only 22 are 80 or older this year, with the oldest at 85, according to the Boston Athletic Association. As a practicing endocrinologist who specializes in treating patients with hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, Holick said he's running in tribute to young people with the rare genetic disease, which wreaks havoc on the body's connective tissues. Distance running is also Holick's strategy for strengthening his own body in hopes of minimizing the side effects of his cancer treatments and ultimately extending his life, he said. Having low testosterone and remaining anemic are two significant impediments that slow you down, said Holick, who lives in Sudbury. They make you want to stop running, but I refuse to let that happen. At 8 a.m. on a recent cold, gusty Saturday, Holick joined dozens of other runners, most in their 20s, in the basement of Boston University's Jenga building along the Charles River. They stretched and mentally prepared for a 20-mile run from Kenmore Square to Wellesley and back. The independent race prep group called the Marathon Coalition also meets weekly on Zoom to discuss training and offer support and encouragement. Holick is the most zealous athlete of the bunch when it comes to his training routine, Coach Rick Muir said. There is no one close to him in age, but despite his age, I would consider him my most enthusiastic runner, Muir said. Holick said he wants to inspire older adults to exercise more, given its benefits for physical and mental health. After receiving his cancer diagnosis in December 2021, Holick began weightlifting twice a week and walking between 5 and 8 miles a day to improve his health before undergoing chemo radiation treatment. At the start of treatment, he made a New Year's resolution to run the Boston Marathon and accomplished his goal in 2024. His time was just over 7 hours. But after 2 years of hormone deprivation therapy and nearly 30 radiation therapy sessions, Holick has become more susceptible to muscle loss and fatigue. Even though it's only a number, being 80 is certainly a challenge, said Holick, who is running this year's race with Team Tufts Medical Center. In his Sudbury neighborhood, Holick completes several 6-mile runs each week, going around a circular road multiple times or running along a train track. His form is strong and he keeps a consistent pace, Muir, 68, said. Muir said Holick has an analytical approach to his training, studying running techniques and asking in-depth questions to understand how the body responds to different workouts. He is like a sponge for knowledge, Muir said. Holick's curiosity about the human body led him to treat patients suffering from HEDS, a commonly misunderstood disease that causes many doctors to give up on patients, said Aurora Stepenix, whose daughter Karen died from complications of the disease in August 2024. She was 24. My daughter would explain it's like your body is a popsicle stick house you put together with defective Elmer's glue, said Stepenix, 55. A piece falls in, and then another piece falls in, and then you're constantly trying to hold this whole structure together. The disorder is thought to affect just 1 out of every 5,000 people, but Holick believes it could be more common. In some cases, parents whose child bruises easily have been accused of abuse, Pollock said. But in many instances, a child's body was actually hypersensitive due to HEDS, he said. While other doctors approached Karen Stepinac's disease with skepticism, Pollock dedicated himself to finding answers, no matter how complicated the girl's symptoms became, Aurora Stepinac said. Instead of giving up and saying there must be something else going on, he actually digs and digs and finds intricacies between hormones and vitamin D levels that affects this disease, said Stepinac, a veterinarian who lives in Medfield. Pollock said he's dedicating his marathon to Kira Sariski, who was 17 when she died from HEDS in 2021, and Karen Stepinac. The disease caused their joints and organ systems to nearly shut down. Before Karen Stepinac died, she asked Pollock to perform her autopsy to study her genome in the hopes of making scientific discoveries. Pollock went on to publish a medical research paper on her case. Every time I think of Karen, I get emotional. I set up her autopsy. I saw her on a cold slab, Pollock said. I'm running because I can't get that picture out of my head. Sariski's mother, Marge Sariski, said she is looking forward to watching Pollock run on April 20th. She downloaded the BAA racing app to track his progress. The world needs more Dr. Pollocks, doctors who will listen to their patients, who will fight for their patients, who will investigate, said Sariski, who lives in Shelburne, Vermont. Muir said he will watch the marathon from outside the Wellesley Hills Congregational Church near the 15-mile mark, the start of what many runners consider the most challenging part of the race. He hopes to lock eyes with Pollock as he passes. It's going to be a very emotional moment for me, because I know how hard he has worked, Muir said. Grant.
Richard, this from the World Pages. Mideast war could strip support from Ukraine. Zelensky afraid for length of U.S. fight with Iran. Article by Sarah Icardes and Samia Kulab. Stateline, Istanbul. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky expressed concern that a prolonged U.S.-Israeli war on Iran could further erode America's support for Ukraine as Washington's global priorities shift and Kyiv braces for reduced deliveries of critically needed Patriot air defense missiles. The U.S.-made Patriots are air defense systems that help Kyiv counter Russia's daily barrages, Zelensky said, speaking to the Associated Press in an exclusive interview late Saturday in Istanbul. Russia's relentless pounding of urban areas behind the front line following its full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 4 years ago has killed thousands of civilians. It has also targeted Ukraine's energy supply to disrupt industrial production of Ukraine's newly developed drones and missiles, while also denying civilians heat and running water in winter. We have to recognize that we are not the priority for today, Zelensky said. That's why I am afraid Iran in the war will give us less support. The latest U.S. brokered talks between the envoys from Moscow and Kyiv ended in February with no sign of a breakthrough. Zelensky, who has accused Russia of trying to drag out negotiations while it presses on with its invasion, said Ukraine remains in contact with U.S. negotiators about a potential deal to end the war and has continued to press for stronger security guarantees. But, he said, even those discussions reflect a broader loss of focus from Ukraine. His most immediate concerns, Zelensky said, are the Patriots, essential for intercepting Russian ballistic missiles, as Ukraine still lacks an effective alternative. These U.S. systems were never delivered in sufficient quantities to begin with, Zelensky said, and if the Iran war doesn't end soon, the package, which is not very big for us, I think will be the smaller and will become smaller and smaller day by day. That's why, of course, we are afraid, he said. Zelensky had been counting on European partners to help make the Patriot purchases despite tight supply and limited U.S. production capacity. But the Iran war, now in its 6th week, has sent shockwaves through the global economy and pulled in much of the wider Middle East region, further straining these already limited resources, diverting stockpiles and leaving Ukrainian cities more exposed to ballistic strikes. For Kyiv, a key objective is to weaken Moscow's economy and make the war prohibitively costly. Surging oil prices driven by Iran's closure of the Strait of Hormuz are undermining that strategy by boosting the Kremlin's oil revenues and strengthening Moscow's capacity to sustain its war effort. In his interview, Zelensky said Russia draws economic benefits from the Mideast war, citing the limited easing of American sanctions on Russian oil. Russia gets additional money because of this, so yes, they have benefits, he said. Russian officials said Sunday a fire broke out at a major oil refinery in the Nizhny Novgorod region after a drone attacked, while another drone damaged a pipeline at the Russian Baltic seaport of Primorsk, home to a major oil export terminal. No casualties were reported. Russia could reap a windfall from a surge in oil prices and the U.S.'s temporary waiver on Russian oil sanctions designed to ease supply shortages as the Iran war continues. Russia is one of the world's main oil exporters, and Asian nations are increasingly competing for Russian crude oil as an energy crisis mounts. In response, Ukraine has intensified its long-range drone attacks on Russian oil facilities, which have rattled Moscow. To keep Ukraine on the international agenda, Zelensky has offered to share Ukraine's hard-earned battlefield expertise with the United States and allies to develop effective countermeasures against Iranian drones. Ukraine has met Russia's evolving use of Iranian-made Shahed drones with growing sophistication, technological ingenuity, and low cost. Moscow significantly modified the original Shahed 136, rebranded as the Zhuran 2, enhancing its ability to evade air defenses and be mass produced. Ukraine responded with quick innovation of its own, including low-cost interceptor drones designed to track and destroy incoming drones. Zelensky said Ukraine is ready to share with Gulf Arab countries targeted by Iran its experience in technology, including interceptor drones in sea drones, which Ukraine produces, more than are used up with funding from Americans and its European partners. In return, these countries could help Ukraine with anti-ballistic missiles, Zelensky said. In late March, as the Iran war escalated, Zelensky visited Gulf Arab states to promote Ukraine's singular experience in countering Iranian-made Shahed drones, leading to new defense cooperation agreements. Zelensky has also positioned Ukraine as a potential partner in safeguarding global trade routes, offering assistance in reopening the Strait of Hormuz by sharing Ukraine's experiences securing maritime corridors in the Black Sea. Zelensky was in Istanbul for talks with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan a day after the Turkish leader spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Zelensky said they discussed peace talks and a possible meeting of leaders in Istanbul. Following the talks in Istanbul, Zelensky and Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan arrived in Syria on an official visit on Sunday, a Syrian state news agency Sana reported. In Ukraine, meanwhile, drone attacks overnight into Sunday killed at least one person and seriously wounded another in the city of Nikopol, authorities said. Richard.
Thank you, Grant. This from the business section of the Boston Globe. Oil markets aren't taking Trump's peace signals at face value anymore. Article written by Amy Phan, the New York Times. How markets respond to President Trump's proclamations about the war with Iran can have big effects on prices. Sometimes the price of oil has swung instantaneously in reaction to his words, and other times the market has shrugged. The market now seems more skeptical when Trump says the conflict may end soon, which means he may find it harder to knock prices downward simply by making such announcements. His pronouncements also come as fighting continues across the Persian Gulf, including strikes on energy infrastructure. A blockade on tankers delivering oil from the region is also factoring into traders' actions. To see this shifting sentiment, let's rewind 2 weeks to March 23rd, when Trump announced on Truth Social a five-day pause in energy infrastructure strikes and the start of negotiations with Iran, which Iran denied took place. Traders reacted quickly, sending the price of oil futures sharply down. Trump's announcement seemed to reassure traders that the Strait of Hormuz, already choked off to oil tankers, would not get worse. Oil prices generally fall when pressures on the supply of oil ease. Iran's main form of leverage is oil prices, said Adam Kobesi, editor-in-chief of the Kobesi Letter, a financial newsletter. As long as prices continue to push higher, President Trump will continue to hedge this military campaign by putting out these headlines to try and contain the market. Since then, however, oil futures haven't responded to the same degree to similar statements by the president. On March 26th, Trump announced a 10-day pause in strikes. This time, oil futures dipped again briefly, but not by nearly as much as they had when Trump announced the five-day pause. And they bounced back close to their previous price within minutes. By the following Monday, March 30th, oil futures had returned to roughly the price they had been before Trump talked about diplomacy the previous week. And the market was now seeming to ignore Trump's pronouncement, in which he often seesawed between diplomacy and threats. That morning, Trump announced that the United States was in serious discussions with Iran about ending the American military campaign. while also threatening to obliterate Iran's energy infrastructure if a deal was not reached and the Strait of Hormuz was not reopened. The market stayed flat. Oil futures by this point might have already priced in the signal that the war would not escalate further. But trade through Hormuz was still essentially blocked, with little sign of improvement, no matter the president's suggestion that the war might soon end. On Wednesday morning, Trump posted on Truth Social that Iran had asked for a ceasefire, though Iran's top diplomat earlier denied that negotiations were underway. In the same post, Trump also wrote, "Until then, we are blasting Iran into oblivion." Again, oil prices remained flat. But that evening, in his televised address to the nation, Trump vowed to continue bombing Iran while offering no new information about when he expected the war to end. That caught the market's attention. As Trump delivered his remarks, the price of oil climbed. After these ups and downs, the price of oil is once again about where it was before Trump announced the negotiations and the pause in strikes 2 weeks ago. It closed at $109 per barrel on Thursday, up more than 50% since the war's start. For U.S. gasoline prices, that has translated to a jump to $4.10 a gallon on Saturday, from $2.98 a gallon before the war, per the AAA national average. Grant.
This story from the nation's pages. Many struggle as food pantry network closes. Multi-state aid ended abruptly with little notice. It's an article from the New York Times News Service written by Sonia Rao and Bernard Mokum. A Minnesota-based food pantry network that served thousands across the Midwest for more than two decades has suddenly shut down, affecting many families already struggling with rising grocery and fuel costs. Ruby's Pantry stocked 85 food locations at churches and community centers across Minnesota, Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Iowa, and provided recipients with grocery bundles typically worth between $125 in exchange for a $25 donation. Volunteers said the assistance was vital for the small rural areas served by the nonprofit. These are folks, oftentimes you can tell by their conditions, their vehicles, that they really need it, said Eric Heppner, the volunteer coordinator of a pantry in Staples, Minnesota. But on March 31st, just a week before his pantry's next food distribution, Heppner said he received an unexpected email from Ruby's. "We have decided to end the operations of Ruby's Pantry effective immediately," the email read. "We recognize that this is difficult news to receive and do not take this decision lightly." At first, Heppner, the director of student life at Central Lakes College, where his pantry has been based for 5 years at the school's Staples campus, thought it was an April Fool's joke. He repeatedly called and emailed the headquarters of Ruby's in search of answers. He never heard back. "We would have liked a little more notice for sure," he said. "The distribution scheduled for Tuesday has been canceled, leaving around 150 families without easy access to food. The closure comes at a tenuous time for many Americans. As the cost of groceries has surged, federal food assistance programs have been threatened, and recent conflicts in the Middle East have caused fuel prices to skyrocket. Volunteers wondered if these financial pressures could have played a part in the closure of Ruby's. According to Heppner, the organization said a few weeks ago that it would be increasing the donation for groceries from $25 to $30. Beth Kennedy, who volunteered at a Ruby's Pantry distribution site in Grand Marie, Minnesota for 12 years, said she noticed the organization's leaders begin to downsize around 2 months ago, selling off storage facilities and vehicles. I think they got in over their heads, she said, pointing to rising fuel costs from the war in Iran as the tipping point. The services Ruby's Pantry provided for Kennedy's small lakeside community, collecting, storing, and shipping food items, were not, she said, something it would be able to easily recreate. Ruby's Pantry sourced most of its food supply from corporate donors. We don't have access to that kind of food, she said. According to tax records from 2024, the nonprofit's expenses outweighed its revenues, although it still held millions of dollars in assets. Roxanne Saar, an executive director at Ruby's Pantry and the daughter of founder Lynn Saar, did not respond to requests for comment. Please note that Ruby's Pantry is no longer in operation, an auto-reply message from her email read. I am also no longer employed with the organization and I am unable to assist with inquiries. Ruby's Pantry's Facebook page posted a statement online, the same message that Heppner and other volunteers received in their inboxes. The website is now defunct. According to an archived version of the website, Ruby's Pantry distributed approximately 242,000 grocery bundles a year. Stacy Silk, who has 7 adopted children to feed at her home in Brainerd, Minnesota, had gone to her local Ruby's Pantry on and off for a decade. Recently, she's had been relying on the pantry more frequently to supplement a tight grocery budget. Everything's doubled, and we're just trying to make things work, she said. For her family, the loss means cutting back on meat, bread, and fresh produce, she said, all of which they usually received in their monthly distribution. We're going to have to live off the canned goods for a while, she said. She told her children, many of whom have special needs. Richard?
Thank you, Grant. Several articles from the daily briefing section of the Boston Globe. Two Pennsylvania firefighters killed in crash. Richmond Township, Pennsylvania. Two firefighters traveling in a utility vehicle along a Pennsylvania road during a search for a missing woman were killed in a head-on crash with a car, officials said. The two members of the Walnut Town Fire Company died after the crash with a Toyota Camry at about 6 p.m. Saturday, roughly 45 miles northwest of Philadelphia. Fire Chief Jeff Buck and Assistant Fire Chief Robert Schick, Jr., were heading north when they were struck by a sedan heading south on Route 222, according to the Berks County Coroner. NBC Philadelphia reported that the utility vehicle was riding on the shoulder of Route 222 when the Camry swerved off the road. Police told the station that a male and a female who were in the Camry when it crashed fled and were later arrested. Video from the crash scene shows the utility vehicle on its side. No further details about the arrest or the search for the missing woman were immediately available Sunday. A call and an email seeking information were made to the Fleetwood Police Department. Autopsies on the firefighters both residents of Fleetwood, were scheduled for Monday. At this time, we would like to send our thoughts and prayers to the Schick and Buck families, the Walnut Town Fire Department said in a Facebook post. Rest easy, chiefs. We got it from here. The article is from the Associated Press. This next article from the Associated Press also. Police chases leave 8 dead across U.S. Troy, Alabama. A series of police pursuits has led to at least 8 deaths around the country in less than a week amid ongoing calls from some law enforcement experts to curb risky high-speed car chases. In Texas, a man fleeing from police died Sunday. In Alabama, 4 people died when a car being pursued by a state trooper went off the road and hit a tree Friday. And in California, 3 people were killed in vehicle crashes during police pursuits in separate incidents last week. The deadly incidents are among the hundreds of fatalities that occur during police chases each year. In 2023, a report from the Police Executive Research Forum, a national think tank on police standards, called for police to put the brakes on car chases unless a violent crime has been committed and the suspect poses an imminent threat. The report noted a spike in fatalities and an increase in pursuits by some departments, including in Houston and New York City. In the case in Alabama, a driver was trying to elude the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency's highway patrol on a rural road in southeast Alabama's Pike County when the crash occurred late Friday night, an agency spokesperson said in an email Sunday. No other vehicles were involved. The driver and 2 passengers, one of them a 17-year-old, were not wearing seatbelts and were thrown from the sedan. And the final article is from Bloomberg News. On Artemis II, the biggest headache has been the toilet. As NASA's Artemis II astronauts make their way to the moon, their test flight has gone surprisingly well without any major issues, save for one piece of technology giving the crew some grief. The toilet. The Lockheed Martin-built Orion crew capsule that's carrying the Artemis II crew to the moon is equipped with what's known as the Universal Waste Management System for the astronauts to use during the 10-day mission. It's roughly the same space toilet that's used on the International Space Station. But getting the complicated piece of equipment to work properly during the flight has become a recurring issue. The UWMS comes equipped with a funnel and a hose for urination, and there is a seat with a hole for bowel movements. Since the astronauts are in microgravity, the toilet relies on airflow that pulls waste into the toilet and ensures the capsule stays clean. The astronauts can also use foot straps and handles to stay in position. On Artemis II's first flight day, the toilet indicated an issue right after the crew got to space. Grant.
Richard, quickly with a look at sports for the Boston teams over the weekend and also a peek at the forecasts for this week. For us, Celtics were victorious at TD Garden yesterday afternoon, early evening, downing the Toronto Raptors. Final score 115-101 as they close in on sealing the second seed in the Eastern Conference of the National Basketball Association. Also, further, the bad news continues for our Boston Red Sox, losing at home to the San Diego Padres 8-6. Sox were leading this game 4-0, but unfortunately were unable to hold that lead and fell to 2-7 on the season, the worst record in Major League Baseball. Also, on the losing end, the Boston Bruins worked towards the end of the season with four games remaining in the regular season and close to clinching a playoff berth, but it wasn't to be in Philadelphia yesterday as the Bruins fell in overtime to the Flyers. Final score in that game, Philly 2, the Bruins 1. Also from the weekend, UCLA's women's team won its first NCAA hoops title, crushing the South Carolina Gamecocks in Phoenix. The final score in that ball game, UCLA 79, South Carolina 51. Tonight, the men's final takes place in Indianapolis. In that game, the UConn Huskies take on the Michigan Wolverines. Again, that game tonight, the final in the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship. Turning to the forecast for the week ahead, if you have not ventured out yet, grab a coat and a hat, maybe a scarf and some gloves still. It's cold out there and blustery today. In fact, I see the word snow. Showers only and potentially limited in its scope, but nonetheless, on this April 6th, they're saying overnight sections of the greater Boston area trending more to the north and west of Boston, but the chance for a snow shower there. Temperatures will be falling into the lower 30s. Today, before we get there, temperatures will top out in the mid-50s, and then we move forward with temperatures being cooler tomorrow. Yes, cooler than today. Temperatures tomorrow highs in the mid-40s and then dipping back into the upper 20s and low 30s. As we move forward, however, the trend once again is a positive one. We see temperatures on Wednesday still cool, but with greater sunshine. And then Thursday, the mid-50s, and then Friday, yes, I see 65 and 70 degrees as possibilities. So hopefully, sooner than later, we'll have that warm-up that we deserve. Thank you again for tuning in here at the Talking Information Center. We appreciate your ongoing support, and hopefully we can continue to provide to you what you need as we move through the year. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thank you all for listening. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069 or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.